I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast, and I'd like to take this small bit of time out of your listening to ask you to support the Cato Institute and the Cato Daily Podcast by becoming a podcast sponsor. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and give a donation in any amount to support our work. If you donate $1,000 before the end of the year, I'll give you a shout-out on the podcast. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to get started. You can also designate a friend or loved one to receive the benefits of being a Cato sponsor. Thank you for supporting the Cato Institute and the values of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, December 21st, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. How private are banks that receive special privileges from the feds? What was the problem the Federal Reserve was created to solve in the first place? Jeffrey Lacker is the most recent former head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. We spoke at the Cato Institute's monetary conference last month.
For people who are only aware of the Federal Reserve as this sort of, it's sort of distant institution that does a bunch of things that we don't know, we don't really follow. Most people don't follow it. They'll follow their interest rate on their mortgage or an interest rate on savings and checking and that sort of thing to the extent that they're able to get anything on savings or checking. But going back in time, what was the problem that policymakers were attempting to solve in creating the Federal Reserve?
It's an interesting question because in the crisis, in the most recent financial crisis, a lot of people claimed that the Fed was founded to address financial crisis, the implication being address it the way that we addressed it now. But that's not really the case at all. So there were financial crises, banking panics in the late 1800s. And the problem they were addressing is in those panics is that the supply of hand-to-hand currency was limited because of the collateral requirements on national banks that issued that hand-to-hand currency. And in times of year like the fall and the winter months when people were needed more currency and less deposits in order to move crops to market and to shop for the holidays and the like, the demand for currency went up. It flowed out of the banking system, and interest rates actually were 100 basis points higher in the fall than in the spring on average, a sort of a bizarre system. And we'd bring in gold from overseas and the like. What happened in banking panics is that there'd be concerns about the solvency of an individual institution and or a couple of institutions, and depositors would try and convert their deposits into currency, and they'd get a lot of currency out, and that would drain some of the currency supply. And there wasn't an easy way for the system to expand the supply of currency when people wanted to shift from currency into gold or what have you. And from deposits, deposits into currency and gold. So it was the problem that the supply of currency wasn't elastic. They had an elasticity problem. And so you see in the Federal Reserve Act, the title of the act is to furnish an elastic currency. And that was the entire idea. So the idea had to do with the monetary liabilities that the central bank, the Fed, issued. It wasn't for the Fed to lend to institutions who couldn't borrow money. That was entirely separate. In fact, there were proposals at the founding of the Fed to include deposit insurance, and they didn't want that because the experience at the time suggested that that engendered too much moral hazard, and they were against rescuing failed institutions who had bad management or had made bad loans.
Who was H. Parker Willis?
H. Parker Willis, fascinating guy, studied at the University of Chicago in the 1880s with Lawrence Laughlin, a monetary economist, a prominent monetary economist at the time, went to teach at Washington and Lee University in Southwest Virginia, Lexington, Virginia, then went to Washington. He was an editor for a national business publication and became Carter Glass, the advisor, economic advisor to Carter Glass in 1913, when Carter Glass was the head of the House Banking and Currency Committee, now the House Financial Services Committee, and advised him in the process of drafting what became the Federal Reserve Act. Carter Glass took the lead on that drafting, and Parker Willis was his main advisor.
given what the Federal Reserve has done since 2008, we are well beyond, and in fact, we've been well beyond, even going back further, well beyond what the purpose of the Federal Reserve was supposed to be, as you say, creating an elastic currency.
That's right. And the interesting thing is the way the role of the Fed's credit extension authorities and abilities have morphed over time. At the beginning, that was just the way to increase the money supply. So you've got a set of institution reserve banks, and they're going to provide an elastic supply of monetary liabilities. What assets would that institution hold? Well, government bonds were right out because of the association with wartime finance, in the sense that if you let money be backed just by government bonds, government would sort of impose upon the institution the obligation to issue. I mean, you get inflationary finance, and there are plenty of examples of that. So that was too undisciplined. So they wanted something that would deliver the right sort of quantity of money over time. They settled on something based on the real bills theory, it came to be called, which is the notion that if the monetary liabilities issued were backed by lending by banks that was connected with the real needs of commerce, that then the supply of money would expand when the needs of commerce dictated that there was a need for more money, and then would contract commensurately when it the opposite was true. And there's a number of fallacies involved in that, and so it became discredited. And pretty soon after the Federal Reserve Act, the Fed's monetary policy became divorced from lending, in the sense that they started to acquire government securities to help finance World War I. By the mid-20s, they discovered that open market purchases of treasury securities were sort of a more effective way for them to influence monetary conditions than lending. And part of the reason is that they could do it without having their fingerprints on interest rate changes, whereas a discount rate change was highly visible and exposed them to political attack.
So did the fact that the Federal Reserve began engaging in sort of open market operations, participating in market in financial markets in a direct way, mm-hmm. Did that serve to discipline the Fed at all in terms of its behavior?
No, I think it clearly felt responsibility for price stability. I mean, after the World War I, they took pretty dramatic actions to try and bring inflation back down again, and felt that responsibility acutely in the 20s, and I think did a reasonable job by historian standards of doing it through the 20s, where they failed in the early 30s because the real bills doctrine was leading the leading thinkers at the Board of Governors astray. They thought policy was easy when it was really pretty tight. And what the real bills doctrine gets you to do is focus on different types of credit. And the underlying thesis is that there are sound types of credit connected with commerce, and then there's speculative credit, excessive credit creation. That idea has not died. And just what its sort of economic foundations are, I'm not quite sure.
So I'm thinking back in time. If you're talking about the Fed being called upon or being created to solve a problem in which interest rates go up in the fall and fall in the other seasons, that seems like an opportunity for people in a market to solve. What prevented the people in those markets from solving that problem?
National banks had a monopoly on hand-to-hand currency, and there was this legal restriction that currency issue had to be backed by holdings of U.S. Treasury securities on a particular list, and it had to occur via a particular mechanism. They had to go into they had to contact a bank. So picture a little bank in, you know, Lexington, Virginia. They'd have to contact a correspondent bank to buy a Treasury security for them. They'd have to send that to the Treasury. The Treasury would get their plates off they'd print some notes, they'd package them up, insure them, send them. It would take, you know, weeks.
Okay, so part of the problem then that the Federal Reserve was trying to solve by centralizing some of these activities was a technological one.
Well, I'd view it as a problem with the legal regime under the National Bank Act. I think it was widely recognized that one path to solving the problem was to just let national banks issue notes without that collateral constraint, backed just by the general assets of the bank. They said on this system that essentially involves creating nationalized universal membership clearinghouses. So at the time, there were clearinghouses in the major cities. And when a banking panic occurred, they would sort of band together their members, back all their members' liabilities, and they would sometimes issue these illegal things called clearinghouse loan certificates that would circulate just like money to expand the money supply, but they wouldn't let people take their assets out of the clearinghouse system. So clearinghouse had sort of a collective solution, but their membership was just the Citibanks. And because we also had these laws that prohibited branching. So unlike Canada, which had nationwide banks, we had these banks in cities and clearinghouses, and then we had all these little country banks, and they called them country banks. And the country banks had these relationships with Citibanks, but in a pinch, the Citibanks would sometimes cut them off and not ship them more currency to use to meet withdrawal demand. So in some sense, the problem they were solving was the governance of banking panic resolution arrangements that were dominated by the clearinghouses, perceived as dominated by the clearinghouses in the city, who decided life or death who was going to be backed up and who wasn't. The country banks got cut off in the panics. They wanted someone who they'd have some influence over, except for sort of this commercial relationship. So the idea was you'd form the Federal Reserve Banks were formed as these clearinghouses for given regions, and everyone in the region was entitled to be a member of the Federal Reserve Bank. And that in some sense, the direct effect was just to nationalize what was going on and make it universal member and change the governance arrangement over the decision about who got currency in a panic.
With historical context, given what the powers that the Federal Reserve assumed in 2008 and beyond, the authority is still not clear. What concerns does that raise that the Federal Reserve, the last two Fed chairs have said, you know, this was okay. It's okay that we did this, and it's okay that we're going to maintain control of these authorities going forward. Are there too many levers? Is that a problem?
I think there are. The Fed was given at the beginning these lending authority to banks at the discount window. In the Depression and later, there was an accretion of other powers, 13-3 and the like. These are vestigial and these are tangential and unrelated to monetary policy, the core mission. But they offer this tremendous ability to the Secretary of the Treasury, the FDIC, of off-balance sheet using federal, taxpayer resources. They started doing that in the early 70s, late 60s and early 70s. We started with the FDIC rescuing uninsured investors in failing financial institutions. That set up expectations that I think pretty clearly led the financial system to behave in a way that relied on this implicit backstop, the expectation that the New York Fed would make sure everything worked out pretty well okay in the end. And I think that led large financial institutions to structure themselves in a way that ran greater risks of liquidity problems, that made themselves more vulnerable. So this moral hazard problem isn't just the cost of their funding. It's that it makes the funding that elicits Fed support more attractive relative to long-term debt.
So these are
for example.
So how do we think about those large banks then in terms of their institutional role? Because if these banks are essentially privileged in a way mm-hmm. that other banks are not, I mean, how private are they?
It's a great question. They've been benefiting from, an implicit insurance contract, an implicit line of credit. And problem is the ambiguity about the discretionary deployment of Fed lending authority. And that's a problem that hasn't been addressed. And that's a problem that is always most problematic in the early stages of a crisis where, are they going to rescue Bear? Are they not? They rescued Bear. Does that mean they're going to rescue Lehman or not? And without clear boundaries, without a clear mandate, without a clear set of policies about who we do rescue, who we don't rescue, policymakers are always driven to rescue the most, because if you fail to support, then the probability of you supporting a bunch of other people goes down, and that causes volatility. So it's always going to be more attractive to extend the support, extend the implied line of credit to a broader range of people. And we've seen that over time. There's a calculation that I got some people at the Richmond Fed to do while I was there. The fraction of financial firms' liabilities, so the entire financial sector, all the firms, count up all their liabilities, what fraction benefit from explicit or implicit government support, government guarantees?
Don't know.
60% now. In 1999, it was 45%. And that's with a pretty rigorous definition of implied support, which is established precedent or announced policy. So not, you know, speculating about who they're going to support. This is people they've supported before. And so people would have a good reason to believe they're going to support again.
So I've talked with several people about this, and we'll close with this question. With respect to rules versus discretion, it seems that a dual mandate allows monetary authorities to engage in all sorts of discretion. Should we get rid of the dual mandate?
So that's a fascinating question. I personally believe that the conduct of policy would not be materially altered if we adopted a single mandate, and the politics of getting rid of the dual mandate seem infeasible, absent just squeaking it by with a narrow majority. And my view is that the Fed shouldn't operate on a mandate that got by on a narrow partisan majority. So I'd prefer the Fed to try and navigate. I like Greenspan's old formulation, which is price stability is the best contribution the central bank can make to full maximum employment. Volcker's formulation as well.
So
work with it that way.
In a sense, then, the Federal Reserve isn't observing a dual mandate, and we're just sort of pretending that it's out there. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So the downside of what I advocate, sort of leaving it alone, is that it provides room within the committee to turn the dial in the direction of trying to provide short-run stimulus to employment. And that's just a fraught enterprise. But I think we've seen that tilt emerge in the last 2 decades under the last couple of chairmen.
Jeffrey Lacker is the most recent former head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. We spoke at the Cato Institute's Monetary Conference last month. As we are now knee-deep in the season of giving, I'm asking you, the unflappable Cato Daily Podcast listener, to financially support our work promoting individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace by visiting cato.org/podcast sponsor and learn about the benefits of sponsorship. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor.